We lived on beer and kisses, all hopped up on love and foam. Get home from work, turn on the lights, sit on the couch, spend the whole night there.
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Amy Rigby. She's a songwriter, musician, and performer. And we're talking about her new book, Girl to City, a memoir. Amy, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks, Mark.
I've actually enjoyed your music for a while. So that's a, I have to make a confession to that to the audience. So this book really was two things to me. First of all, it was a great sort of tracing the evolution of you as a musician into sort of becoming the musician you want to become. But it's also a great portrait of New York City at that time period. And that was outstanding. The late 70s through the 80s. That was a time to be in New York and to be into music, I'd say, wouldn't you?
I feel like I was lucky to be there. And I guess I didn't realize in writing, you know, my own little details about, you know, what it was like for me, how many people would kind of see parallels and say, like, I went there too. I remember that. You know, it was a really nice thing about writing about the past.
I went to the Stiff Record office there in New York City at that time. It was at CMG conferences in New York City at the time. And all the bands you mentioned were bands I was playing at the time. But the great thing is you through this whole thing. Because you really sort of reveal it all. You are careful with names, I will say that. But let's talk about your early years, your early years. Your birth name is Amy McMahon.
Right.
You grew up in Pittsburgh. And I love some of the details. You had a really nice family. But I love the fact that you were enamored of Elton John.
Yeah, I just fell in love with him.
Was that your first musical influence?
No, I mean, I definitely liked all the pop records that they were playing on the radio back in the 60s and, you know, just like all of that, even the stuff my parents listened to, like Herb Alpert and Burt Bacharach and all the musicals, you know, like Sound of Music, and I loved all those songs. But I think, you know, Elton John was, and you know, I loved the Monkees. I was a little
Who didn't love the Monkees?
I know.
The thing is, actually, I love them now more than I love them now more than I did then.
Yeah, no, I you know, they were there. I was like the perfect age group for the for the Monkees back then. But Elton John is the first one that really kind of spoke to me as like, oh, this is like an artist. He's a, you know, he writes these songs. You know, I learned, yes, that there was Bernie Taupin writing the lyrics, but, you know, that he just created this whole world in an album. You know, the whole idea of like the artwork and the liner notes and just all the credits. And, you know, that those were the first, his records were the first ones that I really, they weren't just singles, you know, they existed as a whole unit in an album and told a whole, and each album told a whole story. And that was really like a powerful, you know, introduction to that for me.
There's so many great memories from when you were a teenager, like the first time you heard Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
it seemed like it was a life-changing event.
It was, and it really, it just, you know, when these things happen, I don't think you don't, as a child, think like, I'm going to remember this moment forever. But it just was such a strong memory that I held on to it forever, and just like this visceral moment that you know, just was so powerful. And I have, you know, I can't say, you know, I wouldn't want to choose like Bob over Elton. I spend much more and have spent in the long run much more of my life listening to Bob Dylan than I have to Elton John, because, you know, he just like keeps me interested. You know, I can't say I've listened to a current Elton John album, but yeah. I've just listen to Tempest, you know, that Dylan put out in 2012. You know, I've just listened to that like repeatedly since I saw him back in whenever he played in New York City. I guess it was back in November.
Now,
back in November. So
yeah.
He played a couple songs from that album, and it made me kind of just go rushing to, like, I had missed it when it came out. But anyway, I'll keep discovering his stuff forever, whereas Elton, you know, I feel like we had our moment.
Wow. It's like you're talking about lovers.
I know. I never really even, like, compared the two of them before or thought about it that way. But yeah, they definitely, like, you know, they both hold, like, really, like, big places in my heart.
And this is from your own writing. There was, from the beginning, there was a need that you had to distinguish yourself somehow. And
yes.
And when I read that line and then finished the book, I realized that was what your music was ultimately about. It was that need to distinguish yourself.
I guess so, yeah. And that was a great thing about writing, about my life. Like you mentioned, my family.
Yeah.
I think I realized in writing about my family, like, gosh, I was lucky. I have a wonderful family. And that was like a great, even though I would, you know, tending to, like, you know, because I am part Irish, like, look at the negative side and be like, you know, my dad doesn't understand what I'm doing, you know, and kind of lean towards the sort of more negative view. But it was in writing about it that it just dawned on me, oh my gosh, he was always there for me in his way. So I think the other voyage of discovery was just kind of figuring out that music was just like my way to, yeah, like stake some sort of, make a stake, you know, like be something, exist in the world somehow.
But originally you were on a completely different track, and that's what brought you to New York City.
Yes, yeah. I thought I could be some sort of visual artist or something in fashion, or, you know, like I just, part of it was the times, you know, it was still like the early 70s when I was even thinking about this stuff, and you just didn't see very many women doing
That's
music,
right.
So I think it just... You know, the options didn't seem as open as they became over the last decades of the 20th century.
So here you are in New York City, a mere youth in 1976, and your observations, and for people who aren't old enough to remember, what was New York City like at that time? It was a very different place than it is today.
Yeah, it was kind of... there was a lot of vacant lots. There were a lot of, abandoned buildings. There was a lot of garbage everywhere. There were abandoned cars everywhere, like along the sort of, you know, the arteries, the roads, you know, like not the actual like streets where people lived, but if you went along like the FDR Drive or anywhere like coming in or out of the city, there just were cars just left there. I don't know. It did feel like it had sort of been neglected and forgotten by the people in charge, which made it seem kind of like a playground in a way, not for the rich, which it feels like now, but for the people who didn't have any money.
I mean, there were places you were told not to go.
Oh yeah, very much. Very much.
But of course you went there regardless.
Yeah, that was like a red flag, like, oh, you definitely want to go there. I went to Parsons School of Design, and the advisors told us, like, whatever you do, don't go east of Third Avenue. And so it was kind of like,
it's
well,
like
what's over there?
As you fall off the edge of the planet.
Yep, exactly. So it now, just made it that much more appealing.
There's a whole list of romances and involvements, which we can't possibly do justice to in only a half hour. and you're very upfront about all of it. And we're going to have to skip around about it. And I want to tell people who are listening, there is so much juicy details in this book about music, about love life, about just being in New York City. It's great. But I want to mention Bob.
Yeah.
Just give me a one sentence how you would describe Bob, other than he's automatopoetic.
He was the first person I met who was just crazy about music. And that had a huge influence on me.
He took you on your first trip to CBGB's.
Yes.
And who did you see?
Well, in the book, we saw the Ramones, and that's and that is how I remember it. It might not have been, you know, it could have been this benefit that had like every band, which I guess could have been as good of a scene, but that's the thing about writing this stuff. You kind of just have to lead with what your impressions are. It's not, you know, and you're trying to tell the truth, but some of this stuff you can't even find historical data to.
That's right.
To prove. So in my mind, we saw the Ramones, and as I was writing the scene, it was the first time I saw the Ramones at CBGB's, and I was picturing them there on the stage, and it just was like a physical force.
There's a song you wrote much later on about dancing with the Ramones, wasn't it?
That
you recorded with Reckless Eric?
No, I actually recorded it before I got together with Eric, but I recorded it in 2005 for my album called Little Fugitive, although Eric and I did play the song together a bunch.
The Ramones made a big impression on you.
They did. They did. And Joey especially. And I kind of, you know, kept up with what he was doing for years after the CBGB's days. Just really loved him.
It seems also really important that you get to see a lot of female performing artists. And you write about people like Lydia Lunch, the Slits, Delta 5, the Raincoats. You get a chance to see all those. And for people who are not old enough to remember those bands are incredibly important. And the music still sounds great.
It made a huge impression on me to see women playing instruments, dressing in a really interesting way.
Yeah.
Not presenting themselves like I say in the book. I saw the Runaways at CBGB's,
wow.
And somehow they were a little bit of a letdown to me, just because I felt like they were doing kind of the same thing that the guys did, but just in like girls' outfits, you know. And that wasn't as compelling to me as seeing the Slits or the Raincoats just making this noise that you'd never heard made before. Lydia Lunch too, just being expressive in a particularly feminine way, but that was not like, you know, cute and sweet and pleasing. It seemed radical.
I'm going to go through a couple of names quickly because I want to make sure we get this in the interview. Talk to me about Stinkies.
Stinkies was a homemade club in 1979, just a bunch of friends from the Parsons dorm, and we shared dorms with, well, it was an NYU dorm, actually, so a lot of friends who went to NYU had started some bands, and we all just like swapped records and talked about music and went to see shows, and we decided to start our own club, and it was just a basement on St. Mark's Place.
Wow.
And we weren't, there was no intention to have live music. We just wanted it to be like a dance party. And so we all just like rolled up our sleeves and kind of built this place that after a couple weeks was shut down by the police.
But then
neighbors,
wasn't that also the era of stair kits?
And then, yeah, and so then that Stinkies eventually kind of landed at this club on West Broadway that was called Tier 3, and it was a sort of like a failing lunch spot that these two women owned, and they let us start doing the dance parties there and then started booking music there. And so Stair Kits was my first band, where I played the drums.
Cool.
One of my brothers was in the band. Bob played guitar. Wow. And then another friend, Angela Yeager, sang, and you know, she'd actually met the Slits. she'd been to London, and yeah, so she was kind of like, she just like was a leader on the scene.
At this point, have you pretty much given up the career idea of doing graphic art?
I guess so. I mean,
the siren song of music is like drawing you further and further away. And when you read the book, there's just more and more stuff about music.
I think I realized somewhere along the way, because I was trying at first to make a living like doing freelance art, and this was pre-computer. I mean, this was like rubber cement and X-Acto knives era. And I think once I started really playing in bands, or once I started writing songs, the idea of like hiking a portfolio around and trying to sustain some kind of freelance art career just seemed impossible. Like it was hard enough, like sending out postcards for gigs, and or maybe it wasn't hard, but it was very labor intensive and kept me really busy. So I decided at that point, I'll just make a living doing office work or whatever, you know, something on the side that I, you know, that isn't as important to me as doing music. But the whole graphic art thing has, I mean, all through the years, like I've always really liked coming up with album concepts, covers,
yep.
You know, doing, yep. And then, you know, doing, you know, now it's like making Instagram posts, making, you know, making banners for ads for, you know, which more, I mean, none of this stuff existed back then. You'd have to make a flyer, you know, and take it and get a Xerox made. But and maybe make some postcards to send out, but that was it as far as like letting people know you were playing. Now, you know, if you're a musician, you spend so much of your time trying to spread the word about any project you have going on, any show. You know, it's like a full-time job.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Amy Rigby, songwriter, musician, performer, and we're talking about her book, Girl to City, a memoir. I'm going to really have to skip a lot of romantic stuff and travels and get to Last Roundup. Now, this is amazing because the sound of Last Roundup was what was then called cowpunk. And I never saw that coming when I was reading your book. All of a sudden, you got very interested in that kind of music.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I think part of being from Pittsburgh, we were like an hour from West Virginia. And so there was, I think, maybe a desire to distance yourself from being, you know, kind of country or hillbilly. There was a radio station in Pittsburgh called WEEP. And that was, I think, like the greatest country music station call letters ever. I never listened to that. But in the early 80s, I just started listening to old country music and just being really inspired by the songs, especially.
Especially the songwriting. You talk about people like Skeeter Davis.
Just the way they would tell a story. A Loretta Lynn song would just tell like a really kind of regular people kind of story that I really related to. And whereas with punk, I'd never felt like I could be the one writing these sort of, you know, really like almost like violent anthems, or they were just pure self-expression. I never felt comfortable expressing myself that way, but when I could kind of treat it almost like a short story or something, I found a way into writing music. So,
well, you sign a deal with Rounder, and actually you tour throughout the South. You go down to Nashville, you play a lot of gigs, but at the same time you're married and eventually you get pregnant, you're on the road.
Yeah.
Now, nowadays people do that and there's a lot of support. Back then, that was a really daring thing to do.
Yeah, it was, it was kind of, I guess, a little impulsive to even think that I could do that. But I think I had thought, oh, maybe if I have a baby, then I won't be doing this music foolishness anymore. I thought it would turn me into a normal person somehow. But how did that
work out?
But instead it somehow, it kind of made me stronger.
Yep.
Touring while pregnant was not easy, but at the same time, I think it maybe made me like speak up for myself more. So that was good. And then once I had the baby, it just seemed like there was a whole other subject matter to write about and to sing about. And also, like, once you've had a kid, I think you want to remember the part of yourself that isn't a parent, and just kind of keep that alive.
And her name was Hazel, and the book is dedicated to her.
Yes, at the time when I got pregnant, last roundup, we'd met the singer Hazel Dickens, who was just such an incredible performer and a musician and songwriter. She'd grown up in West Virginia and sang songs about coal mines and about working people, and she just was a huge inspiration to me.
And so,
named her Hazel.
Amy, we have to talk about the Shams. I mean, you're working a job at this time too. There's a new band that you are in called the Shams. Describe to me the lineup of the Shams.
The Shams, was two other women and me. We were all part of the original last roundup, which had started with four girls singing in harmony and sort of, changed over a couple of years that we existed. But the Shams was Sue Garner and Amanda Uprichard and myself, and they were, my two dear friends, and we, I like to picture that we were like a coffee clatch, like we were just sort of a couple girls sitting around the table talking about everyday things. And so it was a good vehicle for those kind of songs that I wrote. And we just had this great blend. Our voices just seemed to support each other so beautifully, and the other girls really supported me when I had like a newborn and then being on tour with a baby in the van.
Wow.
They were just super, we would like pass her around, not while we were driving, of course, but yeah, like backstage. I mean, although like back then, like car seats were, really kind of almost like a new thing that they,
that's
yeah,
right. That's
they,
right.
They weren't anywhere near as comprehensive as they are now, but.
And the Shams were successful. You did things like open for the Indigo Girls.
We did a tour opening for them. Success is all relative.
Yeah.
We did a lot of gigs, and we put out an album on Matador when Matador was really just getting rolling, and we played in New York City a lot. I would say in a way we were successful, but we still struggled, that's a crazy thing, like when you open for people, and then you go back to this place where you played in front of 1,000 people opening, and then you're still struggling to get 40 people.
Yeah, I know.
So yeah, it doesn't always translate into.
Now we only have minutes left, Amy, and I hate to rush this part of it because it's very important in the book. There's finally the decision that what you need to do is go out on your own to write your own music and to play your own music, and that was a huge decision for you.
Yeah, I mean, I'd been writing the songs for my band, so and making demos. I mean, I just wrote hundreds and hundreds of songs and recorded them on a four track by myself. So I had felt too shy to actually get up in front of people by myself or to put something out with my own name on it. And it just became clear the time was not limitless, and that I wanted to justify like all the time that I was putting into music. I wanted it to add up to something, and I guess I just wanted to have my voice be heard. So I started playing shows by myself and working on an album, on a solo album.
And that's Diary of a Mod Housewife.
That's right.
That was the first album I bought that was just you.
That was just me.
And it's a great album. What happens is your songwriting really shines in your independent albums. And it becomes much closer to what you've always admired throughout your entire career. You know, a really well-crafted song.
That's great. I mean, I think, yeah, I developed it in Last Roundup and The Shams. But by the time I got around to wanting to do my own record, I felt like the songs had become so much, just what I wanted to say, my voice, that it wasn't really something to sing in harmony with other people. It was basically like, no, I need to put myself out there as an individual, which was really scary.
It is scary.
A scary thing.
Now, is your latest album The Old Guys?
Yes.
And that's a great album. I just want to put that plug in there right now. We're completely out of time. As a matter of fact, I have that album right here, right now.
The Old Guys.
there's a great song about Pittsburgh in that.
Oh, yes.
My guest tonight has been Amy Rigby. She's a songwriter, musician, performer, and we're talking about her book. It's a great read, Girl to City, a memoir. Amy, it's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's been really fun.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Mitchell.